Will Jackson Hole get grizzly? Have to say, I am pretty proud of this question, Guy. Let's pose it to Greg Jensen, Bridgewater Associates co-chief investment officer, who's joining us now. Greg, is the market prepared for whatever the chairman's going to have to say tomorrow?
Well, I think, I mean, just like the montage showed, I think most people know that the Fed's going to be describing their tough dilemma, that they're going to have to keep raising rates despite the fact that the economy is slowing. It's slowing at a very high level, but it is slowing. And so they're going to have to be discussing that. And on the margin, that's probably bearish. It's most bearish because despite the fact that so many commentators, as your montage show, are saying the Fed's going to have to tighten a lot more than they have, and that you shouldn't fight the Fed and such, the markets don't reflect that. Market conditions reflect inflation falling quite dramatically towards the Fed's target over the next 18, 24 months. And the markets are pricing for that decline in inflation to occur in a relatively stable economy. If you look at the stock market, actually the expected earnings over the next decade haven't come down at all this year, despite the decline in the equity market. It's all a function of interest rates rising. It's not at all a function of a readjustment of the view of earnings. So over time, well, I think actually the Fed has telegraphed what they're going to say, and it won't be a huge difference in what people expect in the short term. The longer term drying up of liquidity due to the quantitative tightening, the reality that starts to set in that inflation is more stubborn, the Fed tightens longer, that the expected easing in 6 to 9 months doesn't materialize, and at the same time, profits and economic growth are weaker than people expect, is going to make this a tough road for assets. So while we'd be concerned with kind of the consensus among many analysts that the Fed is going to tighten more than expected, the fact that the markets don't price that is the kind of interesting divergence at this point.
How does the Fed get the market to price that? What needs to happen to get the market to price that?
Well, I think that continuing on the path that they're on, right, raising interest rates, continuing quantitative tightening will work and will have the effect. It will drive down inflation. I think, unfortunately, it's going to drive down inflation and the economy together, and that inflation is going to be more stubborn, and you're going to get the movement that probably in the short term is higher interest rates across the curve, and particularly on the long end, but higher interest rates across the curve, and asset prices generally declining. They need to. Essentially, if you take the last decade, the reverse of these policies led to the situation where financial assets rallied so much more than the cash flows in the economy do. Generally, over very long periods of time, those things are aligned. The cash flows in the economy have to pay for the asset prices. We've gotten to such an extreme on that. While this year has started to reverse that, we're still something like 25, 30% above the normal relationship between cash flows and asset prices, which means there's a significant decline to come to kind of align the real economy with the financial economy. And we think we're in the midst of that. The deglobalization and definancialization is kind of the secular wave that we think we're in. And that means, you know, on the margin, like what you see in initial claims today, the employment market, labor is gaining in share, which societally is a good thing. And at the same time, corporate profits are likely going to need to decline in share. And you're at the point where the economy is struggling to grow because essentially labor market's very tight, capacity is very tight, and rates are rising. So I think what you're going to see is more strength in the real economy than in the financial economy. The financial economy converged to the real economy, and that's a big move in financial assets, a big downward move in financial assets in total. To some extent, that'll be in bond markets. To some extent, that'll be in the equity market. But in aggregate, let's say asset markets declining in something like the 20-25% decline from here.
Okay, so that's not a very pretty picture, Greg. How do you invest through that?
Well, I think you have to look at it from the bigger picture perspective, right? Investors have benefited from the last decade. You can't totally, again, if you're a long-only investor, you're not going to be able to totally avoid this. You can be in safer assets, you can shorten your duration, you can lower your risk. Of course, Bridgewater has the opportunity to go both long and short. And so we have no bias in our alpha products that can go long and short and aren't always long. So it's a totally different story for us. And when you look around the world, there are so many major things going on. So if you're long only, I'd focus on lowering risk and on being much more diversified than most investors are, both globally diversified and environmentally diversified. If you have opportunities to trade across the world, of course, the huge balance of payments changes that are happening, the fact that inflation problems are very varied across the world means some countries have policymakers that are really stuck, like in the US and even more so in Europe. And some countries, let's say like Japan, where policymakers aren't nearly as stuck. So you have wide divergences, some of the biggest divergences we've seen in the last 40 years. I'd say it's kind of once in a 15-year kind of set of opportunities when you look around the world.
Greg, can I just come back to this issue of financialization? Wow, that's a hard word to say, of the economy. QE created a lot of rich people. The rich got richer. I'm wondering if QT is the exact opposite. If you're in the wealth business, is that how you should be thinking about it?
Yeah, I think it's the drain. What the Fed did with quantitative easing, and this is one of the things that, you know, I started studying the impact of quantitative easing in 2001, 2002, as U.S. interest rates got close to zero then, again, 7 or 8 years before the Fed even moved to quantitative easing. But Japan was starting to play around with quantitative easing. And we started studying the Great Depression and other periods where increasing the balance sheet was the main mechanism through which monetary policy was controlled. And if you look at it, quantitative easing floods the markets with liquidity. You can't just judge it. We think the Fed's consistently kind of underestimated the impact by looking at the impact on the yield curve or the long rate. But it, what it actually does is floods financial markets with assets. And if those assets move out of the bond market into other assets, it has a large effect, right? And that's why in the U.S. it had a huge effect. In Japan, it had a very minor effect because most of the money that went to buy bonds went back into bank reserves, where in the U.S., you buy long-duration treasuries and mortgages, that money ends up in the stock market, that money ends up in emerging markets. So a very different flow. And now, yeah, the reverse of that in the U.S., in the U.S. bond market, that that selling and the fact that you have to draw the buyers from other assets. So now that you're kind of cranking out $500 billion of extra debt that needs to be purchased by the by other sort of private sector individuals, you're seeing that. That's drawing money out of other asset classes and out of the real economy to some extent. So we do think you're going to see a reversal of what QE did, which was pull financial markets far away from the underlying cash flows and bring that process in reverse.
Greg, as we're having a conversation about tightening in the U.S., we're having a very different one about easing in China. They're unleashing, it seems, pretty much every day, at least some form of stimulus or a plan to stimulate the economy. Is China able to stimulate its way out of the issues COVID zero and crisis in the property sector have created?
Well, it's an incredibly difficult set of economic circumstances in China. You're dealing with a debt bubble, a real estate bubble. Almost every country that goes through that has a significant deflationary impact. China's trying to manage that at the same time, as you said, they're managing COVID, they're managing the geopolitics of Taiwan. I mean, it is a many different goals trying to be managed simultaneously. And that's dangerous. All governments trying to manage different things have to weigh many things, and it's a very difficult machine to weigh things correctly. So I think you're seeing that they're having a very hard time managing all those goals simultaneously. And to some extent, the economy has suffered as they put other goals in above that in financial markets in China. Now, I think they're always going to measure how much of that suffering in financial markets and the economy is worth it relative to the other goals. And there'll be a seesaw effect of more stimulus. Now, the bigger problem is the type of stimulus in China. They continue to try to do supply side stimulus, more infrastructure, those types of things. The lever that they're not pulling, which is the lever that will work most aggressively to offset their kind of inflation, labor problems, is demand side. Just like the US and Europe pushed money through COVID out on the demand side of the economy, China has refused to do this. That leaves them like two points. They really don't want to do it. They've seen some of the issues it causes in other countries, and they have a lot of reasons why they don't want to do it. But it also leaves them with a arrow in their quiver that they could always choose to do in a way US and Europe can't. US and Europe, when you're suffering an inflation problem and in Europe a currency problem on top of an inflation problem, you can't solve the next problem by just printing money and handing it out to households. In China, you actually could solve their current problem with that. But in Europe and the US, you see the ramifications of that and see the constraint.
Greg, final quick question. You mentioned Europe and how tricky the position is. How short are you in Europe? And do you think you'd like to be shorter? How big is the problem here?
Well, I'm not going to get into our positions at that level of granularity, but I would say the macroeconomic conditions for Europe are a disaster. I mean, you look at the need to ration energy, the fact that inflation numbers are going to be so far above the ECB target, into one of the more major contractions that the euro area has seen. We think the contraction in Europe over the next 6 to 12 months could be something like a -4% contraction. So this is extreme challenge. And I can't claim to be an expert on how the electricity prices and that will resolve. But even without that degree of problem, you face extremely difficult choices between inflation and growth into a slowing economy, how the ECB deals with those trade-offs. So we think that the risks around the European macro situation are about as grave as they've been in a decade.
On that note, that cheerful note, Greg, we will leave it there. Thank you very much indeed. Really appreciate your time. Thank you as ever. Greg Jensen, Bridgewater Associates, Co-Chief Investment Officer. Always a pleasure.